Hey everyone, it's Lindsay here with a surprise episode and a surprise announcement. As you might know, our goal is to finish our reread and discussion of The Running Grave by August-ish of next year, just in case. And so we were preparing to have longer episodes, but it became very clear with this last recording that the episode was just going to be too long in our opinion. And so what we decided to do going forward is to keep our recording schedule the same, but split one recording up into two episodes and release them weekly instead of every other week. For those of you that like longer episodes, don't worry, they're probably going to end up being around the same length that you're used to, given that this episode here is only half of what we recorded. The one difference that you might notice in today's episode is that in the intro, Ken says that we're covering chapters 5 through 10, but because we split it up, this episode is going to be chapters 5, 6, and 7, and next week we will post the remainder of this recording with chapters 8, 9, and 10. We're going to make some updates to our website soon to reflect this schedule change, and we just think that this is going to be better overall for everyone, and we hope that you're excited about a weekly schedule, and we hope that you enjoy this week's surprise episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 5 through 10 of Part 1. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series. But before we get started on the chapters, we do have a couple of things that we wanted to talk about. And the first thing is going to be the super special edition of Cuckoo's Calling.
Ooh, super special.
Super special. Not just special, but super special.
I still can't get over the fact that I tweeted about, hey, what happened with this? Mm-hmm. And next day, they're like, you idiot, it's right here. I'm sorry.
Oops.
I mean, I think the book it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I understand why some people are underwhelmed because when they promised exclusive artwork, they know what fans want. We want to see the characters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even so, the map is lovely, but I get why some people feel that way. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, the price was
a lot. Yeah.
Having said that all, did I buy one? Of course I did. I still want it.
Yeah, and so did I.
I think I would rather regret getting one than regret not getting one. That was my thought process.
Same. There's only like 1,000 of them, right? They were saying it was like a pretty limited run.
Yeah, so I'm excited.
So moving on from that, though, we got the Q&As, which we were just talking about last episode, and these were so good. Honestly, I can't say enough good things about them. I just kind of wish we'd gotten information on book 8, but that'll come with time. Honestly, what we got was awesome.
A little tease would have been good, because I think with Ink Black Heart we got the younger demographic, right?
Mm-hmm. But we know nothing about 8.
We know
right?
Nothing yet. Nothing. No, just that she's writing it.
Well, that's enough for me.
It is. Yeah, me too.
Written, I'm good.
When the Q&As were happening, I took a look at the Facebook comments, and oh, yeah. There was a lot of disappointment because they were pre-recorded.
Yeah,
I think I knew. I mean, we all knew what we were going into, right?
Yeah, those of us who have done this the past few years, we knew what we were getting into. There's nothing live.
That's just how they always are. But I understand if you don't know that, then it's going to feel, you know.
Yeah, disappointing. Like if you're getting up at 5 a.m. because you're anticipating a live discussion, that hurts. I get that.
Well, last year they advertised it as interactive when it was only interactive because you had to click the links.
I mean, that's barely even technically correct. Come on.
I think it's totally fine that this is how they're done. I enjoy these. And I know that Jo has said that she doesn't want to do as much promotion as she did for Harry Potter. I just wish that the Robert Galbraith team would be a little more clear. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I wish a lot of things about the Robert Galbraith team, but that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, but anyway, I agree with you, Kent. I think we got some really beautiful things, especially about Strike and Robin's relationship or Strike's personal growth. I love listening to Joe talk about them. I really hope that one day when the series is done, she'll do a more open and spoilery discussion, because I can tell that she tries really hard not to say too much, and it's kind of difficult sometimes.
Yeah,
because she doesn't want to give anything away. And you know, if she's looking for a place to do that,
I was about to say, I have the perfect venue in mind.
I know.
Yes,
it would be the dream, wouldn't it?
Literally the dream.
She's done a fan podcast before, so it's not impossible.
It is within the realm of possibility.
I admit the possibility.
We all admit the possibility. Let's manifest it. Let's work on our vision boards. Let's try to go pure spirit and make this happen.
Okay. All right. Well, should we actually get into the question that we're going to do?
Let's
do
it. All right. So the Q&A for this episode is, what can you tell us about the leader of the Universal Humanitarian Church and their role in the story?
The supreme leader of this cult is a man called Jonathan Wace, who is extremely charismatic. He's not fire and brimstone. He very successfully conveys the message that he's humble. He's open-minded, he's tolerant, he, as a couple of the characters talk about, seeing him as the father they wish they'd had, or feeling that he too understands what it is to be an outsider. He's not what Robin expects the first time she visits the temple. She's expected someone who's very fired up, a sort of evangelical figure, but he seems quite self-deprecating. At the same time, he's very sexy. He's a good-looking older man. He's exactly what I think many of us would almost aspire to be. He seems very certain. At the same time, he appears superficially to be questioning. He's very inclusive. He seems to be very inclusive. He's preaching a seductive message. He's saying there is truth in all religions. Let's unite them. Let's come together across cultures and explore what are the common truths in religions. Now, that's an interesting starting point. And it's certainly something that I think about a lot myself, because I've always been fascinated in mythologies, how across mythologies and very discrete cultures, cultures that won't have interacted for thousands of years, similar archetypes arise, similar creation myths arise, because that seems to me to tell us something about what it is to be human. So the differences are fascinating, but the commonalities are equally fascinating. And Wace is on top of that. Wace is saying, you know, we've all got a different take on this, but let's bring this together. So he's clever. He's either the Messiah or a complete charlatan. So what draws people in is the potential for good. And Jonathan Wace is very, very good at selling his church as something that does an enormous amount of good.
I think this answer is such a good example of how these Q&A sessions usually go, where she's giving an early book perspective of a character and not giving anything away, because all of us know that most of these things about Wace aren't true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He seems that way, but we know he's not.
Yes.
I don't think he's truly humble. We know he's not tolerant, especially if you're gay or lesbian, right? Mm-hmm. We know his church doesn't do good. The list goes on and on. I think the only things that are actually true are probably that he's charismatic and arguably that he's sexy. And you need to be one or both of those things to get that kind of following.
Yeah, you really do. I mean, how many of the women in this book were drawn into this cult specifically because they fell in love with Wace? Like, it was more than one. That's an asset
definitely
that he's using. Yeah.
It's funny because a few of us were chatting as we were watching these. And when Joe said this, the consensus was that he is not sexy. We were all like, ew,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
But clearly she means physically. And like you just said, we absolutely see that in characters. I know this goes a little off topic, but I liked our little discussion about Wace not being sexy to us, because I think it's a good example of what books do, because it doesn't matter to us one bit how a character is described physically, because we love them, find them sexy, unsexy, hate them because of their literal character.
Yeah.
It's a nice example of how things should be, but absolutely are when you read a book. Yes. I don't know if that's nonsense, but I couldn't help but think of it.
No, it's not nonsense. Great. And this happens all the time in real life. Someone becomes sexy to you because you've fallen for who they are as a person. Exactly what happens to Robin.
I definitely think that happened with Strike anyway for like a lot of readers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, big time.
This one in particular. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Anyway, it's hard for me to believe that Wace believes the things he says about there being truth in all beliefs and non-beliefs. Let's combine everything. I think it's just a great tactic because it opens him up to even more potential victims.
Yeah. Syncretism is an incredibly appealing approach because it appears to make a coherent whole out of a multitude of fragmented and disparate parts. So I think that that is inherently satisfying to someone who's seeking truth and order, the prime target for this cult.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I too share Joe's fascination with this kind of thing about certain ideas existing across many cultures. She's going for what it means to be human. And that's not surprising because we know that she has such a good understanding of human nature. But I can't pretend that I didn't immediately think Bigfoot, mermaids, ghost stories.
Very on brand for you.
I know. I know that's not what she meant, but in the back of my mind, I'm always like, how are there so many similar stories? I'm fascinated by this kind of thing.
Oh,
so I loved hearing her talk about this basic human need for understanding and stories.
You know, it's inherently human to search for meaning through stories. And that is a topic that you will never get to the end of because it's so fundamental and that's thrilling. Also, can I request Joe, Ms. Rowling, JK, I would really love it if Jo published a book with all of her random thoughts on this topic pulled together. Random thoughts on all topics. I would really love Jo to publish a collection of essays and musings. I would pay so many dollars for that because I think it would be fascinating and brilliant.
All right. Is this a good place to put our new listener question?
I think so. We got a lot of really good responses to this one.
We did. We put out a question that said, do you have any questions about the Running Grave that you'd like to hear our thoughts on? Ask us anything and we'll do our best to answer. Now, because we got so many responses, we can't answer them all now. What we decided to do is answer one at the beginning now and kind of separate them out across episodes so we can do one in the beginning each time. And also some of them are really specific to certain parts. So some of the questions we'll put in the actual chapter discussion. So I hope that makes sense.
That makes sense to me.
So if you don't hear your question today, we'll probably get to it another time.
Yep.
The question that we chose for today is from Bettina. And she says, I would love to hear your takes on the whole having children / neglecting children / saving children / abusing children / parenting theme. And if it foreshadows anything regarding Robin and Strike, maybe bridging it over to the whole divine mother love theme.
It's a really good question.
It is a good question. I would actually like to ask our listeners to send in responses to this as well, because I bet that there would be some really beautiful and thoughtful ones. Mm-hmm. I think that this connects with the theme of why you become what you become, that unanswerable question of nature versus nurture. We've seen many examples of this with who Strike is despite his childhood versus a lot of the killers or bad people in the books, right? And as a parent, I spend a lot of time thinking about my choices, my personality, my examples. How are those things going to show themselves in my children when they're adults? And is it going to be good or bad? Mm-hmm. I think it's a big thing in the books. There's such a significance and an importance being placed on parenting and how our choices impact the next generation and what bad parenting can do to a person. But there's also the opposite going on with the importance of personal choice or personal goodness. And I don't know if I think it foreshadows anything for Strike and Robin. I just think nature versus nurture and the importance of parenting is a big theme in the books. This would be something that I would love to ask J.K. Rowling about and see which way she leans, because she has given one of her main characters this unanswerable mystery too. You know, is he good because that's just who he is? Or is it because Ted and Joan stepped in?
Oh, that's such a lovely answer, Lindsay. I totally agree with you about parenting being important as an element of that larger theme and who we become. With every story in these books, every murder, every side story, Rowling has made sure to show us how the past shapes the present, especially in this book. And in so many of these stories, the actions of parents have created the present that Strike and Robin are now dealing with. The ramifications of generational abuse or of parental mm-hmm. love, no matter how imperfect. It echoes down and through the children they raise. Look at Lucy. Her attempt yeah. to restore order to the world is by fixing the mistakes of her mother, by doing parenting right. And Strike acknowledges in this book that that is a valid and courageous way of dealing with her past. Having said that, I don't think Strike and Robin will end up having children themselves. I feel like their baby, you know, the good that they put in the world that will echo on after them, will end up being the agency and the relationships they build with the younger generations of their families. But that doesn't negate the importance of parenting in the world to make a better world, right? It's one of the most important things you can do, really.
As far as Strike and Robin having kids, I'm firmly in the camp of the agency is their baby. I can't see them planning to get pregnant.
We were asked this question the other day about if our opinions on that have changed. The answer is no. I still don't think that they're going to, but it's also one of those things that I don't feel like I care. I don't have a huge investment in that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
If it were to happen, then I think that she would do it beautifully. And I be like a puddle? Of course. But I just don't think so. I just don't see it.
I'm in the exact same place as you. Yeah. I'm not invested in a no being right. And I just don't think, you know, they're
exactly
going to.
That's where I'm at too.
I'm on this ride wherever rolling takes us. I'm buckled mm-hmm. in.
Whatever it is, it's going to be great.
Thank you for that question, Bettina. I really liked that question. We should do this at the beginning of every book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if any of our listeners have questions to send us that you haven't already, please tag us on Twitter, submit it through email, you know.
Website.
We'll add it to the list. Yeah. We're going to make a doc that we just put these questions in and kind of go through them to make sure that we're answering things that people want to hear. So. Mm-hmm. Okay, but should we start with chapter 5?
Let's do it. So in chapter 5, Strike and Robin discuss the case and her going undercover. So the epigraph for this chapter, 6 in the 5th place means giving duration to one's character through perseverance. This is good fortune for a woman. And that is from hexagram 32, duration. For this one, I'm wondering if maybe this is speaking to Robin making the case for her being the person to go deep undercover to Strike. But I'm wondering what you guys think.
Well, first of all, I'm trying not to sing Wicked. Can't say good fortune to me and expect me to not say good fortune, witch hunters.
Oh, you're mm-hmm. in trouble for the rest of the season then. Because the
I know,
does that
because it
lot.
Gets stuck in my head every single time. I just want to scream it. Good fortune, witch hunters. Anyway, this hexagram is about marriage. And it's used again later on in a more direct way to Strike and Robin's relationship, I think. But I don't think that that's relevant here. Mm-hmm. I think it might literally be talking about the character of Rowena when it says giving duration to one's character is good fortune, because Robin has spent so much time and given so much thought to this character, and doing so will bring her success. Not really with pitching it to Strike, in my opinion, because we know he's already come to the same conclusion that she's the best for the job, but it will bring her success with the UHC and getting recruited.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. This is very much talking about the character that Robin is creating and perseverance in taking on and working this case in every respect. In the actual interpretation for this line, the I Ching argues that it is right for the woman to hold conservatively to tradition and the man to be flexible in being guided by his duty. Well, Robin is definitely not conservative here, but she is holding fast in her argument that she should be the one to go undercover, as is traditional in these books, actually.
Yeah.
So yeah, Strike is the one who needs to be persuaded, who bends under her persuasion and their duty. This is another example of what I talked about in the last episode about Rowling playing with the patriarchal foundations of this text, because in the original text, the woman should be traditional conservative because she's in the home. She's not out in the world. The man needs to be flexible because he's the one interacting with the outside world. But in this book, she's playing with this to give us an incredibly powerful woman in Robin and an even more powerful partnership between Robin and Strike. Oh, it's just so great.
It is. I know I keep saying this, but I love these epigraphs. These have to be my favorite of the series so far.
I think it's going to end
up being mine. It's going to be really hard to beat this one.
It was hard to beat Ink Blackheart for me. I really liked Ink Blackheart's epigraphs, but
it was hard to beat Troubled Blood for me because I really love the Fairy Queen. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. This is going to be up there.
It definitely is.
Starting off this chapter, we join them again at the Golden Lion after their interview with Will's family. And Strike's opening line of this chapter is gold.
Yeah, it is. But before that, I just want to note that this is a really interesting parallel to something that happened in Lethal White, because in Lethal White, they meet at the Red Lion to talk about Robin going undercover for the chisel job near the beginning. And Robin is drinking orange juice in both pubs. We remember it gets spilled on her dress in Lethal White.
Oh, I definitely
remember. I'm sure we all remember that.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very Gryffindor colored, red and gold, orange flavored parallel. Reading these two different scenes back to back is, which I did, is fascinating in terms of where they were professionally and personally in the Lethal White Red Lion versus the Running Grave Golden Lion. They're fun chapters to pair. I recommend going back and reading them together.
Interesting. I feel like there's an alchemical argument there.
Yeah, something with the red colors. And gold, the rubido.
Right.
I don't know if orange juice can be used in alchemy to dissolve things. I feel like, why not? It's an acid.
Why not? Let's
throw it in
there.
It might
be a
bit sticky. Put some vodka in there and you've got a party.
A literary alchemy party.
I'm not an alchemist or an alchemy expert, so I'll leave that to the experts, but it is very interesting.
I love the opening line of this chapter where Strike says it's fine that she accepted the job without talking to him first. I'd have said it myself, but I had a mouthful of potato.
It's so good.
It is. It's just fun for me that even though Strike has lost so much weight and we see lots and lots of fish, we didn't lose any of the food-related Strike humor, if that makes sense.
Thank God.
It still feels like we got a lot of that. You know, Strike and food, it's the other love story of these books.
It's
really
true.
Beautiful.
Honestly, that's the love story I relate to the most. Bless him and his chips. But also, you know, evidence of how in sync they are, both being on the same page about taking this case, while also giving us a little reminder of Robin's passion for justice, which equals Strike's, and for helping people in pain in her immediate response. And of course, we get Strike's equal passion for potatoes.
I mean, potatoes, like pasta, are forever.
I mean, you know what? All the starchy carbs. I'm not picky.
So I'm not sure if either of you checked out the menu for the Golden Lion by chance, but I have to say, after seeing a bunch of the menus for places like in recent books where everything is expensive as hell, it's really nice to see a place featured with much more reasonable pricing.
I guess it's like Robin said in Ink Black Heart, right? It's not the Ritz. It's just a pub.
It does look like it's just a few blocks away from the Ritz, though, which I was kind of startled by how close together these locations in London are.
Well, that's what I was talking about in our last episode. This particular area,
yeah,
there's just a ton of them all right here.
Chock full. It is.
Great place to go.
It's nice to see the cheaper restaurants for the people in London who are able to visit locations, because they can't keep shelling out for like the Cinnamon Club and stuff. It wears on the wallet. You got to have some cute, cheap pubs. That's just considerate, I think, of Jo.
She knows that.
We're going to all these places.
She knows. She's very aware.
So once they get settled, the very first thing that Robin brings up is how much money would be needed for all of the real estate that they own, which is a small detail that we end up finding more about later and actually ends up being really significant.
Yeah, it does. She zeroes right in on that red flag of suspicious illegal activity. And I kind of wonder if Matthew talking about money all the time left her with some kind of accumulated knowledge and instinct about money stuff, like real estate prices. Like maybe she knows more than most people because Matthew never shut up about it.
Maybe. We kind of touched on this last time, but it's interesting how easily I forgot about the money stuff once Robin was inside, because I was so distracted by the fear of everything that could possibly happen to her that I wasn't even thinking about this anymore.
Yeah. When I was thinking of stuff they could take the cult down for, I was focused on murder because these are murder mysteries. I completely overlooked the possibility of other crimes, even though I had predicted trafficking. Like I completely forgot my own suspicions because I was worried about Robin and I'm thinking about murder and everything else just flies out of my head.
I agree. I was fooled by this too, because I think that there are so many hints in the book that point towards baby trafficking, including, in my opinion, the personal pregnancy scares with Bijou, Robin not being able to take her pill. I think that those were all pushing us towards baby trafficking, babies, right?
Yes.
And J.K. Rowling did a really good job of hiding that in plain sight with the fear of everything else, the bigger fears for Robin. At least it worked on me.
Same.
Do you know what I just realized? When I was thinking about the Lethal White parallel that I mentioned earlier, but in both books, The Running Grave and Lethal White, we've got an angry oldest brother, James, Jimmy Knight, and a vulnerable youngest son, William, Billy Knight. How did I not realize that before?
I didn't either.
What? I mean, we've got Ed thrown in here as well, but Jimmy's short for James and Billy's for William.
Yeah, I didn't realize that the names were the same.
It's so Jimothy. Crazy.
Jimmy isn't short for Jimothy.
This has got to be signaling something about the Knights versus the Ensers, right?
Yeah.
He put it together with the explicit connection with the chisels last chapter. It means something that I haven't figured out. And why is Ed here? Where was Ed in Lethal White? Like, what's going on?
I don't know. Maybe it's something, a way of playing with our expectations, showing different family dynamics in similar circumstances. I don't know.
I guess showing how different fathers result in two very different pairs of sons, even from the same blueprint.
Yeah. Maybe we'll put a pin in this and
think about it a bit.
Think about it a bit. Yeah. Maybe someone else has some good thoughts on that too.
I would love some, because it's the same names. That's not a coincidence. That's something.
So this next part is interesting to me. Strike and Robin are talking about James and Zer calling Will an idiot for joining a cult. And Strike says he thinks that people who join cults generally have something missing. And when Robin counters with, what about Giles Harmon? Strike says, I'm with Orwell. Some ideas are so stupid, only intellectuals believe them.
I've just spent the last, how many, 7-odd years in academia, and I'm at the point where I would chew my own arm off to escape because, it's entirely accurate. I don't just know one person like this. I am surrounded by them. But, interestingly, this quote, the Orwell quote that Strike says, it appears to be a misattribution. We're going by wiki quotes because I was trying to figure out where Orwell said this. And apparently this quote could actually be a paraphrase of Bertrand Russell, who said, this is one of those views which are so absurd that only very learned men could possibly adopt them. But it is similar in meaning to an actual Orwell quote, which is, one has to belong to the intelligentsia to believe things like that. No ordinary man could be such a fool. But even if it is a misattribution and Strike is wrong, she had to get Orwell's name in here early because of all the echoes later on with books like 1984 and Animal Farm, but the Orwell reference is important, I think.
So now we get to the fun stuff, and this is when Strike and Robin start to get into what might be necessary for somebody to properly infiltrate the UHC and get Will out. And this next bit really makes me laugh, where it says, Strike, who knew perfectly well he was listening to a pitch, said, and I'm guessing you don't think Barclay, Shaw, or Littlejohn would be convincing as wealthy god-botherers. And Robin's arguments against each of their subcontractors taking on the job are great and show just how well she knows them, especially Barclay. That one really made me laugh. And then also her comment about Littlejohn was just fantastic.
I was kind of curious about what Barclay would say to this, because I'm not convinced that he couldn't be serious if he had to be. Not that I think he's a realistic option because he has a child, but I'm just curious if he would say, hey,
I mean, he did do a good job in Lethal White, going undercover to get close to Jimmy Knight. So, he might do okay. I don't know. Some people are physically incapable of resisting the urge to make fun of something for too long. I don't think I could be serious enough.
But if you're in the position where you're in danger.
Yeah, maybe. Probably.
Of course.
I would have killed to see him taking the piss on all the ridiculous aspects of the cult, though. It would have been so funny.
Speaking of things that were making me laugh earlier, Strike's awareness that Robin is basically auditioning for the job here is really great. I'm just imagining him like grinning on the inside while she's doing this. Like, yeah, I know what you're doing.
I was really happy with how this all unfolded here, because there was a lot of speculation before the book came out about how Strike would feel about Robin going undercover like this. Mm-hmm. Everyone was wondering, is he going to be angry about it? Are they going to fight? So I was really happy to be able to put that to bed so quickly.
Yeah.
And I don't think that Strike is ever going to be super carefree about Robin being in potential danger. And just because he loves her, but because that's just who he's always been. He's a protector, right? Mm-hmm. See the stuff with Lucy. But I was just really happy to see them in total agreement about this right from the start. It's a nice change for me from them butting heads in Ink Black Heart. Mm-hmm. And I'll never not love his ulterior motive for wanting her away from Murphy, because same.
Right.
Same.
He is so petty in this book, and I love it.
I mean, I wouldn't really expect him to be any other way, because I'm not sure I would use the word super petty, or I don't know. It's just his reactions seem very human and normal, like, and I'm feeling them on his behalf too.
I've seen criticism of Strike for this moment, but I think it's important to note that the Murphy thing is explicitly a secondary motive. His main reason for sending Robin to the cult is that she is genuinely the best person for the job. The Murphy thing is just a nice little bonus. It's not actually influencing his decision here.
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
If anyone thinks that Strike would actually send Robin into a dangerous cult, simply to get her away from a boyfriend. I don't know, she maybe didn't. Start a reread, because that's not who this man is.
No.
Like, and to me, that is just an absolute reach to try and find something bad about him, which I do think people do. But come on, that is not happening.
That's ridiculous, that's not what was happening. Yeah.
I'm about to throw something down right now. Not what's happening.
Everyone back up. Insane. Lindsay's going to throw hands. Like, oh my take God. My earrings.
Come on. Anyway, here's another thing that we all speculated, and in my case, freaked out about, was Robin's hair.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Anyone who listened to the episode when we talked about the synopsis with Kurt, you'll know that we were freaking out about this. It's so funny. Because I'm going to log this as one of those things that I really didn't need to worry about. I was so worried that she was going to dye her whole head and it would never go back to normal. But that's just not what happened at all. And even later in this book, it said that her hair had grown out. I doubt it's as long as it was when it started, at least in my mind, but it's basically back to normal, right? I was worried about nothing, which is the story of my life with these books.
Just with these books?
No. Oh boy. No, we entered into a therapy edition because, okay, sorry. That's fair. No, that's fair.
Oh my God. I feel like Robin's hair was one of the things I was worried about most in these books, aside from Robin herself.
But when Robin says that she needs a radical haircut, Strike's response about there being no need to shave her head as a joke, I think it's a bit of foreshadowing for the absolute dread that I would feel later because of the very real possibility of that happening to her.
Shit, you're right.
I know we've already talked about this, but I almost need to process it more because I cannot express how afraid I was of that happening to her. It was the closest I have ever come in these books to skipping ahead because I almost couldn't take the fear. Yeah. It was the thing I think I was most afraid of because it was the most possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling myself that I was being ridiculous. I was trying to talk myself down. It's just hair. If it happened, it would be okay. But it didn't help because that's a lie. It's not just hair. It's so much more than
it
that.
It really, really is. I'm
trying to think through why the thought of this is so very upsetting. Because, it was to me as well. And I suppose with all the other horrific things that happened to Robin in the farm, much worse things than a shaved head. To be clear, all of the lingering trauma from that is internal to Robin. It's something that she can deal with in private on her own terms. And we know that Robin is she's a private person, and presenting a strong face to the world is really important to her. Whereas her hair being shaved off, that is a very significant part of her presentation of herself to the outside world. It's part of her identity. It would have been an incredibly visible trauma, one that would invite comment and concern from other people for a long time after she left the cult. And she would not want that.
Right. Remember when Robin, she compares the cult to a cancer, and then she also thinks that on the outside, she would assume that it was a result of cancer.
Yes.
Almost like it is.
Shit. Yeah, that's right. And then, of course, Strike likes her hair.
I know.
That was such a cute little aside.
It was so cute. If the worst had happened, I bet he'd have told her she looks gorgeous. He would have made her laugh about it. Told her he had a bit of a crush on Sinead O'Connor in the 80s or something.
I think another part of it for me is that it's meant to cause shame.
Yeah.
It's literally like that scene in Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe that's what you're saying too about showing it to the world, showing your shame to the world and everyone you come in contact with. And it's just so dehumanizing. Yeah. I'm sure we'll find more ways to express ourselves and talk about this because it's one of the most horrifying parts of the book for me. Anyway. Let me calm down with something cute because I think it's very cute how Strike is grinning at her when she's giving this whole Rowena backstory and all her ideas. Because he does the same thing in Ink Black Heart when he told her, you're good at this detective shit, right? And I love him admiring her work and her skills.
It's so sweet.
It is. And it's such a nice contrast to earlier books with Matthew belittling her work.
Totally. I have to say, I love anything that gives us an opportunity to dunk on Matthew books after he's left the picture. That's great.
I will take any chance. Yep.
Yeah. But it is, though, when Joe talked about in the Q&As about Robin has something with Murphy she hasn't had before, like a partner who accepts her work. And I was like, okay, fine. But hello,
he's standing right there in front of you.
He's the alternative.
Yeah.
Okay, next is where Robin talks about needing to get some expensive clothes to fit her character persona. She says, The only problem is clothes. I don't look like I've got loads of money, clothes-wise. You always look great, said Strike. Thank you, said Robin, flushing slightly. I want to know if Strike noticed the flushing. I need to know these things.
I hope he does. You know, I wonder what Robin is going to think about comments like this now in light of the ending and everything.
Oh, I know.
She's going to have to reevaluate. She's going to be a little hamster wheel in her brain for weeks trying to figure all this out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
Okay. I know this is a very silly thing to think of, but when she mentions that her shoulder bag is 6 years old, she'll have bought that right after she started working for Strike. Because there's this line in Cuckoo's Calling when Robin finds Strike drunk in the pub. It says, she left him staring hazily at her handbag, which she'd placed on the stool. It was comfortingly familiar, brown, a little shabby. She usually hung it up on a coat peg in the office. He gave it a friendly smile and drank to it. So she must have replaced, I know, she must have replaced that bag right after, since it was getting a little shabby, right?
Or, yeah, because if it was shabby already, it wasn't just 6 years old.
Or I guess she could own more than one shoulder bag, which is reasonable. Yeah. But I just like the idea that this one, her main bag, is as old as her relationship with Strike, and that it replaced the one she had before she knew him. She got new Strike, she got new bag, and now they're both 6 years old, you know?
I don't think that's silly, because I mean, I thought the exact same. As soon as she said 6 years, I was like, that's 6 years, you know? Oh, I thought the same thing. Add me to the silly club.
We're in the silly club.
We'll be in together. There together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, vice president, president, treasurer, secretary. We've got all the roles.
Yeah. 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 This entire thing is great, where he says she can come borrow clothes from Prudence and that he's told her all about Robin. Very sweet. It's also so sweet to me the way he doesn't say the word size when he's doing his little "you're the same."
What is he gesturing to there, Strike?
I know.
Is it a tip to toe gesture or is it focused?
Yeah, he doesn't want to make any direct reference to her body, I think.
Such a gentleman.
Oh, man.
I think we all know he's carefully observed her to guess her size.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I desperately want to know what Strike has told Prudence about Robin.
At this point on my first read, I was hoping desperately that Prudence would let something he told her slip so that we'd have some idea, right?
Right.
Although, given that what he's told her gave her the clear impression that Robin was the most important person in his life, I'm guessing we'd be delighted.
That's a pretty big thing that she did say.
It is. It's a big thing. And it hints that he's told her some big stuff.
I found it a little strange that Robin didn't know that he and Prudence had become this close. Mm. I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense just that she didn't know they were on such close terms that he feels like he could just offer up her clothing, you know? But I do remember thinking it was a little strange that he had told Prudence so much about Robin, but not the other way around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess things are still a little bit weird with the whole Ryan thing, but I don't know. Maybe those walls will come down a bit more in the next book.
It's also probably just a way to introduce
that.
It does serve a functional purpose. We just like to think that they're real people.
Yeah, it's a thing we do.
Oh boy.
Also, interesting comment about Al that he's still mad at Strike about not going to Rokeby's party, isn't it?
2 years later.
I guess Al can hold a grudge.
Get over it, Al. Like, come on, man.
Seriously.
Prudence needs to give him a talking to, I think.
It just felt like something to me that might come back in the next book, like a tiny little reminder of what happened. Mm. I'm wondering if we're going to see Al pushing for another Rokeby meeting soon. And if so, if Al will be successful this time.
You know what? I'm going to throw out a book 9 Rokeby meeting.
Prediction?
I think it could even happen in 8. There's a lot of Rokeby mentions in this book, I think.
I agree.
It's possible for me.
I think it could be book 8.
Yeah.
I know we predicted that we'd get it this book.
One day we'll be right.
We also predicted it for 6 as well. So, listen, you know,
forget those other predictions. This prediction is the right prediction.
There have been a couple people who have emailed or DM'd us letting us know that they're brand new listeners and they're going to start going back from the beginning and listening. And my immediate reaction is, please don't judge us for all the things we were so wrong about.
Right.
It must be weird to listen you know things that we didn't know then, you know?
Like a time machine.
But anyway, the chapter ends with Strike saying he's going to scan all the documents they just received from Sir Colin for Robin. And I remember being half excited, half full of dread, because I knew that Strike was about to read these documents the next time we saw him. And I was like, oh boy, he's going to the connection to the commune. I was probably mostly excited, but I knew something big was coming.
I think it was mostly dread for me. I was like, oh God, what is he about to read?
Yeah. All right, should we jump into chapter 6?
Let's do it.
Chapter 6. Robin thinks about not thinking about Strike, as well as her relationship with Murphy.
So the epigraph to chapter 6 reads, six in the fourth place means a tied up sack. No blame, no praise. And that's from hexagram 2, the receptive.
I had to think about this one for a bit because it's a really shippy chapter, but not a very sentimental epigraph. My first instinct was to say that Strike is the tied up sack, emotionally speaking. He's kept his feelings for Robin hidden well enough that she doesn't believe that he could ever feel the same or want the same thing as she does, which is exactly what she's thinking about in this chapter. My header deck says that at first there's confusion, but later gains a master. And I just think that's where Robin is right now. She's very confused because of Strike being this tied up sack.
This is interesting because I was thinking that this chapter was Robin basically double knotting the ties of her own emotional sack, right? But okay. She's really only doing this because she's following Strike's lead in that, and which is very much the receptive position. So...
And interesting that this is the receptive hexagram again. Yes. I was thinking about what you said last time, Pools, about Tayo telling Robin that she's the receptive, but actually Strike being the one who embodies that more. I'm not quite sure if this makes sense. If I'm right that the epigraph is actually talking about Strike and not Robin, I think that adds weight to what you were saying about Strike being the true receptive and Joe sort of flipping some of that male-female stuff of the I Ching.
This is so fascinating to me because I'm wondering if in playing with these positions, as she does, as you've been saying, there's sort of more fluidity than I assumed. Basically, that there are the personal realms and there are the professional realms. And then in the professional, Robin is very much the creative in this book and Strike the receptive. But in the personal realm, Robin is embodying the passivity and the being led of the receptive. And in doing so, she's not actually open at all, but instead incredibly closed down. It's not the right position for her. Whereas by the end of the novel, Strike has stepped into the creative power in the personal realm and is taking action to control his own fate, but then leaving it up to Robin afterwards. I don't know, perhaps the genius of what Joe is doing with this creative receptive dynamic is in making it constantly shifting. Strike and Robin move in and out of each role, balancing each other, each embodying both at different times. In the original I Ching text, it says, the receptive must be activated and led by the creative. Then it is productive of good. Only when it abandons this position and tries to stand as an equal side by side with the creative does it become evil. And keep in mind that the receptive is the female principle and the creative is the male. But in these novels, Strike and Robin are true equals, standing side by side. And they can do that because their position in these roles is never static. You know?
They're literally like the yin and yang.
They're literally yin and yang. In reference to the specific line, I just have to say that the interpretation of it in the text in the I Ching smacked me in the face because it says, the strictest reticence is indicated here. The time is dangerous. Therefore, a man ought to maintain reserve, be it in solitude or in the turmoil of the world. For there, too, he can hide himself so well that no one knows him. I mean, is this not Robin? Keeping all of her feelings tied up in a sack, holding herself apart from Ryan and for her own emotions about Strike to protect herself and then not being seen by anyone because of it. And she's doing so because up until now, Strike has been doing this exact same goddamn thing. The two of them.
I know. I was going to say, well, it's Strike too.
Both of them. It is time for these two they need to burst out from their sacks. They need to spill out from the sacks, their feelings to the universe and to each other.
Yeah, I guess they're both tied up sacks.
They're both tied up sacks.
It's kind of like a chicken and the egg situation. Like, is Robin doing it because Strike is doing it? Or is that just how Robin is?
Yeah.
You know, there's a part of the Q&A where Joe says that she would tell Strike that it's his own fault that Robin is with Murphy since he made himself so unavailable. So maybe that's also playing into why I'm thinking that Strike is more an emotionally tied up sack. But you're right that Robin does the same thing. I feel like I need to stop saying the word sack, though, because we've said it a lot.
We've said it a lot. That's a lot starting of sack to lose talk. All meaning. That's so much
it
sack.
Is. Anyway, at first I was like, I can't really find much meaning to this. There's a ton. There's a ton.
So much.
Yeah, that's a great epigraph
right
there.
You fill up a sack with it.
We could. I think we did.
Yeah, basically.
The first couple paragraphs about this really feels like that kind of setup for new readers where we're told about how she's realized she was in love with him the year previously, decided she needed to fall out of love, and then agreed to a date with Murphy, right? And then we also get the little reminders of the things neither of them can forget, like their hug at her wedding or when he tried to kiss her at the Ritz. I'm still forever shocked that neither of them think about the accidental kiss at the hospital, though, because where is that?
Oh,
I need Robin to think about how his lips felt. I want the details.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Right. The fact that that has never been one of the things that they think about when they're reminiscing about important moments between
them.
He
thinks about it once, doesn't he? But it's been a long time.
It's been a very long time. That moment has been living rent-free in my head since 2018.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same. All
it
of us.
It was a good thing to be given hope when all seemed lost.
It's literally my favorite line of the book so far.
Yeah. Did they have temporary kiss-induced amnesia?
Maybe it's too...
It was too mind-blowing. Like it too they much. Can't even yeah. think about it. Yeah.
Anyway, I think the important bit is when she thinks about how Strike has never shown, in her mind, a desire to have something more than his single life. And mm-hmm. I think that's important because even though Robin now knows that he's in love with her, I think she's going to have questions about this, about what he wants. And I'm really hoping that we get to see them talk about that. I feel like it has to happen in the next book.
This is why I'm praying that he tells her about the vow, which I capitalize in my head always. Because right. that is what she needs to hear. That one simple yes. explanation, exactly how he phrased it in Lethal White, that he wants to build a life with her. That is what mm-hmm. will assure her.
I think we could totally get something like
really
that.
Really hope so.
I think it's needed, but what my question is does she need to hear that before she can say she loves him too? Or is Robin going to lay her armor down and risk everything and tell him before they talk about it? Because I almost would like to see that.
Yeah, I really hope that she is the one who makes the next move, because up until now, it's been Strike. He said the best friends thing first. He went to kiss her. He confessed his love. Robin's yeah. issue is her passivity in relationships and her fear of being exposed and vulnerable. She needs to overcome both of these things for her own character growth, right? And yeah. making the next moves, now that Strike has opened the door, that would be such a perfect way to do it. And I really, really want to see it.
Talk about a crack in the door being important.
I know.
I completely agree with you. I think it's very likely that Strike will make his feelings and his desires clear, but it will be Robin who mm-hmm. needs to step up this time.
Yeah.
yeah.
I think so.
This line talking about Strike's tendency to put up walls and how it relates to Robin is interesting. It says, while some of his reserve had relaxed where Robin was concerned, she hadn't forgotten how quickly it had returned after that night at the Ritz. In short, Robin had now concluded that whatever she might once have wanted, Strike hadn't ever wanted it at all.
What's interesting to me about that, though, is when she talks about how quickly the walls had returned after the Ritz, I wonder if she ever thinks about the fact that he did that because she rejected him. It's not all on her. It's just, I don't know. Does she not see that part of it?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It's like putting up walls after rejection doesn't mean he doesn't want anything with you. It means retreating after rejection.
I know. I don't get that fully.
Yeah.
I was wondering if maybe you can draw some parallels between Strike's two advances. So the near miss kiss outside the Ritz and then the love confession at the end of this book and his reactions to either the outright rejection or the sort of non-reaction at the end of this book when Robin leaves to go with Murphy. So mm-hmm. maybe where Strike after the Ritz puts up those walls again and has an affair with Diet Charlotte in a Robin wig, the Strike after the love confession leaves the walls down, even though she doesn't say I love you back, but also continues to refrain from using sex as a coping mechanism. So the Ink Black Heart thing flipped on its head.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. But I also think that he knew that Robin was leaving with Murphy. Mm-hmm. He knew that Murphy was on his way yeah. there. I don't think that he was expecting anything other than what happened.
No. I didn't think that he thought that either.
Well, no, but your expectations about putting yourself out there, it's going to be huge to his reaction to it, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he was expecting rejection outside the Ritz, but if mm-hmm. he was expecting her to have to leave, he knows that she's going to need time to process that. So mm-hmm. I think that's going to be helpful in his responses.
The two advances are complete opposites in every way, like physical mm-hmm. versus verbal, drunk versus yeah. sober, impulse versus intentional. So yeah, Kenz, I have to believe that his reaction will be the opposite as well. And Lindsay, yes, his expectations are totally different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can we get book 8 yet?
Right. Ooh,
this next line, it says, it was therefore a pleasure and a relief to be with Murphy, who so clearly wanted to be with her. This very much reminds me of what Strike thinks at one point. I think it's in Lethal White about Lorelai, about being with someone who actually wants
yep,
you.
Chapter 11. It says, there was, after all, little pleasure to compare with that given by a woman who really wanted you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that feels very direct.
I really want Strike to show her clearly that he wants to be with her, since apparently declaring that he's in love with her isn't quite enough.
Well, I don't know. It might be enough. Book 8 might start with Robin immediately dumping Ryan and running to be with Strike. I mean, it's not likely, but it could theoretically occur.
That's my question, what I was saying. Does she need to hear what he wants first, or is she going to put her armor down? Because this is her armor, right? What does he want? I can't tell him what I want because he might not want the same. So I don't know. At this point, my only real opinion about book 8 is that she's going to tell him she loves him too, but trying to guess how that happens feels impossible. Right. It's hard for me not to talk about Joe's Q&A about Murphy here, because this is the point in the book where I think Joe was speaking from, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. She doesn't give much away, but she almost says exactly all of this where Robin is thinking about the positives of her relationship with Murphy.
Yeah, Robin's not really letting herself think about any of the negatives or any of their points of incompatibility at all at this point, because I feel like she's just enjoying the companionship and the sex with Murphy. I think that she probably finds it about as convenient to be in a relationship at this point as Strike did whenever he was with Lorelai, because she's, you know, obviously still having trouble falling out of love with him. But next, we were talking about a few minutes ago, we were talking about being able to dig on Matthew many books after he stopped being relevant. This mention of how the sex with Murphy was considerably more satisfactory than that she had with Matthew made me laugh so hard.
One wonders why Sarah Shadlock was so keen to hang on to Matthew if he's that shit in bed. Like, maybe Tom was even worse. So Matthew is Sarah's Ryan, which is depressing.
My honest opinion about this is not that Matthew is generally bad in bed, but that he was so disconnected from Robin and she with him that he didn't care about her happiness or her desires in the bedroom or otherwise, and she didn't want to be intimate with him. So by the time we're seeing her think all of those things, I think that's kind of where they were at. So while I enjoy a Matthew dig, I think there's more to this than just that for
me. I guess.
I'm going to continue thinking he should in bed.
I guess that could be possible.
I mean, that's fine. I know people like that. I just honestly don't think that that's what's happening, really. Yeah. This next bit about how they're both guarded is interesting and, to be honest, exciting for me, because there really is a lack of true emotional intimacy between Robin and Murphy, something that we do see between Strike and Robin. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to talk about their reunions and compare them. Talk about emotional connection and intimacy, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you agree with Robin's sort of pessimism about relationships here and where not being open is just kind of natural?
I don't know how natural it is, but I'm inclined to agree with her, just because I myself am in kind of like a similar situation to her, where I was in a long-term relationship with somebody for like most of my 20s, and only in the past few years have gotten to the point where like I'm single, looking to date people, and it's like, it's weird. But that's just my own personal experience. So obviously your mileage may vary, but I'm in a similar situation to her. So
yeah, I'm not sure if I do. I don't think that she and Strike are going to be this way,
because
they're not. To me, it's kind of a bad sign if you're dating someone for 8 months and you can't be open with them.
I think that's just her trying to, you know, excuse away the fact that they're both super guarded with each other and are not really being fully open.
I think that when Robin and Strike to eventually reach that stage, there will be much more openness between them than Robin is describing here. Because, I mean, there already is. I think that they will both feel able to share the ugly parts of their past with each other without censor.
And when it says that she doesn't talk to Murphy about Strike, obviously she's right to do this, but also very wrong. In the last set of chapters, we see that Robin feels like she should be able to talk to her best friend about her boyfriend, but she doesn't seem to think that it should be the other way around, for obvious reasons.
Very obvious reasons, because of course the person that Robin genuinely desires emotional intimacy with is not her boyfriend. Strike is still her main man, even if she won't admit it, and he ranks highest on the person I want to share things with list.
I have to say, I'm very curious what anecdotes Robin thinks cast Strike in too attractive or amusing a light. Like, I need
literally
specific examples.
Examples. One time he beat off a murderer with a machete, and then he drove battered and bruised 4 hours to my wedding in Yorkshire to crash it and get me back. Totally normal business partner things.
Yeah. But we also know that she admires things about him, like that he's a war hero. I mean, we see her actually use those words, right, to him. We know she admires those things and his sense of justice and stuff. So yeah, I bet there's a lot of things that she feels that she can't say.
I think that Murphy is going to be suspicious of her silence on strike, because being too silent is just as suspicious as talking too much. There is no middle ground that she can strike there.
Pun
intended.
It also makes me wonder if Murphy knows that Strike is her best friend. If he knows that they're declared best friends, because I seriously doubt that he does. And I kind of want her to tell him. Oh,
that could be so messy.
When it says that Robin never told Murphy that part of the reason she and Matthew divorced was his persistent jealousy of Strike, I kind of can't blame Robin for this, because it would just give Murphy more reason to be jealous. Like, oh, it's not just me. But at the same time, it's frustrating because she's making them the same mistake again.
It is so incredibly frustrating. Ryan's jealousy is kind of justified because Robin is in love with Strike.
And he with her.
She's trying to avoid her previous mistakes, but she's not acknowledging what the actual root cause of those mistakes was. She's trying to treat the symptoms here and not the disease. It's not going to work.
If we were typing this conversation, I would give you a fire emoji, because nailed it. Yes, that is exactly what Robin is doing. And then she's frustrated that she's having the same results. But I'm also curious about his divorce, because he's also not forthcoming.
Oh, yeah. Same. There's definitely stuff that he's not telling her, and I very much want to know what that is.
There's also this line that stood out to me when it says, she assumed these things would be discussed eventually if the relationship continued. In a normal circumstance, you'd almost expect a, which she hoped it would, but there's nothing from her like that. It's not that I think that she's like Strike with Madeline, where he keeps thinking this has to end. Like, she's not at that point yet, but her heart is just not in this, and she's not being honest with herself about it.
Yeah, her heart is definitely not in it at all. The way that she talks about the stuff with Murphy just feels so detached, you know?
It does. Yeah.
So here's the end of the chapter, and this bit is really, really good. All this being so, brooding on the emotional subtext of Strike's conversation could do nobody any good and made Robin feel disloyal to Murphy. Strike probably felt safe to say things like, you always look great, and I've told my sister all about you, because she was now in a steady relationship with another man. As she descended into the station, she told herself firmly that Strike was her best friend, nothing more, and forced her thoughts back onto the job in Bexley Heath.
This was another reason why I fully believed that Strike was going to tell her he was in love with her, because she's sitting here thinking that he doesn't feel the same. So I was sure that it was going to get resolved.
Yeah, this part read to me like that part in chapter 45 of Troubled Blood, you know, the startled bison reaction to her saying that he's her best friend, and that you just know that this assumption is going to be turned on its head.
Exactly. You're so right.
Yeah. It's so funny, because I was over the moon in Troubled Blood when they described themselves as best friends. And now I'm wishing that they would just stop thinking that's all they are. Just stop it.
Right.
Move on. God damn it. I love when Robin says that brooding on the subtext does nobody any good. And I'm like, no, Robin, it does.
It does me good.
It does. Enormous good. It is very good. It is like kale smoothie good for us. So, while also tasting delicious. So keep it coming.
Yeah. All right. Shall we move on to chapter 7?
Yes.
So in chapter 7, Strike reads about the UHC.
And the epigraph, this hexagram indicates a situation in which the principle of darkness, after having been eliminated furtively and unexpectedly, obtrudes again from within and below. And that's hexagram 44, coming to meet.
So this is Strike coming to the realization that the UHC is the same as the commune that he, Lucy, and Leda lived in, right?
Yeah, I think so. The way it talks about this dark situation having been eliminated speaks to me about how Strike thinks this is something that he's eliminated from his life, but I don't think that it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think he realizes just how much good it will do him to face this, and how much healing it will bring to Lucy and their relationship.
Oh, yeah. This epigraph feels definitely straightforward to me. The horrors of Strike's past that he thought were dead and buried are rising up suddenly in front of him again. The hexagram states, it is an unfavorable and dangerous situation, and we must understand and promptly prevent the possible consequences, which, I mean, it definitely is a dangerous situation. But I'm so intrigued by your point, Lindsay, that this ultimately results in healing, because that speaks to the cyclical nature of the I Ching. Everything changes. Order becomes chaos, becomes order. Dark becomes light and dark again. Winter becomes spring and then winter. This darkness rising up is what allows it to be vanquished. I'm also interested to note that this hexagram focuses strongly on the darkness as the yin, the feminine principle. It says, the rise of the inferior element is pictured here in the image of a bold girl who lightly surrenders herself and thus seizes power. And I think that is definitely speaking to Mazu Wace, both as she appears in Kevin's letters and, you know, in that later chapter in Lucy's memories.
Okay, so jumping into the chapter, I don't know why, but I really like Strike deciding to stay in the Golden Lion to read the documents. It reminds me of when he chooses to read something at a pub in Cuckoo's Calling and he appreciates the atmosphere. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I guess it serves as an insight into the kind of environment he enjoys being in, his sense of aesthetics, what he finds visually appealing and comfortable. And yeah. I like it for the same reason that I love every time Robin throws shade and calls some building hideously ugly, yeah. because I want to be inside their brains and know what they like and dislike. It gives us a better sense of who they are as people, right? Strike yeah, likes exactly comfy, it. Dark, Victorian classic interiors with a bit of maybe whimsy.
So the letter Strike is about to read is from Kevin to Sir Colin, explaining how his family ended up at Chapman Farm. There isn't anything about this that isn't sad to me. I feel sad for Louise. I feel sad for all three of those kids, even Becca, because she could have been so much more than what she turned out to be.
She really could have been, yeah.
Kevin writes here that the UHC teaches that normal family relationships or monogamous sexual relationships are a form of materialist possession. So my question is, if you're not supposed to talk about family relationships and you're also supposed to just sleep with whoever, are there times where people who are related end up sleeping together? Because somebody else thought about this too, and they posted this as a listener question response, and it was from Stamping Chat on Instagram. They said, so all of Papa Jay's kids were kept at the farm. Did anyone think that that could get complicated when it came time for spirit bonding, especially since, for example, Lynn didn't know she was related to him? And yeah, how would that not become an issue? Or do they discourage it? But if they discourage it, how can they? If they're talking about flesh objects being bad.
I hadn't thought about this.
I was thinking about it the whole time.
Maybe not enough of Wace's children and grandchildren had reached the age of spirit bonding for it to present a real problem yet. But
it's not just that for me. Yeah. It's like if you're bringing families in and then teaching them those things.
And maybe the principals would have had a way, maybe they'd have come up with some excuse to manage relationships. Maybe the higher ups who have a sense of who's related have some way of discouraging or punishing relationships so that who you're allowed to spirit bond with becomes like an unspoken knowledge, kind of like the non-increasing male thing. But I have no idea because that's going to be an issue. It's a very gross issue.
Yeah, I think that what it might have turned into is kind of how it is with the FLDS, where Warren Jeff's assigned, you're with this person, you're with this person. That would have had to have been what they eventually did because their business is making babies.
They want
to
make healthy babies.
Yeah, not going to happen if there's a bunch of inbreeding.
But if they do make those rules, they're acknowledging family relationships.
Oh, I don't think the church has a problem with contradictory doctrine or hypocrisy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now is when Strike realizes the connection to the Aylmerton commune, when Kevin's letter explains that Mazu Wace had been around since the Aylmerton community days.
The way that Joe writes how this realization hits him is great. She really says a lot with so little, but it almost feels like blows.
Yeah, it's really good.
The rundown barns, the children running riot, the Crowther brothers striding across the yard, the strange round tower standing alone on the horizon like a giant chess piece. He saw it all again. His stoned mother trying to make daisy chains for little girls. Nights in ramshackled dormitories with no locks on the door. A constant sense that everything was out of control and a childish instinct that something was wrong and that an undefinable danger lurked close by, just out of sight.
The way he talks about the sensing danger is really interesting to me because even as a little boy, it's such a Strike thing to do. It tells me that even at a young age, he was watching and observing and had this strong sense of right and wrong.
Little baby detective.
Yeah, he's a little baby detective, yeah. When he talks about sleeping in rooms with no locks on the door, that was particularly sad to me because I can be a bit obsessive about locking the door, but it just paints a picture of there just never being a sense of safety. Like imagine never being able to lock your front door and how that would feel.
Oh my God, a nightmare.
It just makes me sad for Strike because we know that he felt like it was his job to protect Leda and Lucy.
Yeah.
And 6 months of living like that must have felt like a lifetime.
Especially for a little kid.
And then there's a part where it talks about Leda denying the pedophilia after it all came out, and then eventually having to admit it happened, but just kind of shrugging it off and moving on. And it makes me angry on Lucy's behalf, you know, because I know that Lucy said nothing happened, but she's a child. As a parent, to just go, okay, and just not question it.
Like, your kid says, no, I didn't eat that cookie with chocolate smeared all over your face, and you're not going to probe a bit further.
Didn't we say something that we would learn stuff about Leda in this book that would make us like her even less? This is one of those things. Because, like, what kind of parent does that?
Strike says that Leda wrote the incident off as an anomaly. And this phrase interests me because this specific view is so incredibly common in society. When predators are uncovered, we shrug our shoulders and they say, well, it was just the one weird guy, so strange, no reason to change anything we do. So instead of recognizing that sexual abuse and violence are endemic, that predators are drawn to and create situations where they have access to prey, writing off every incident as an anomaly means never having to recognize and address the larger patterns of abuse. It is laziness and willful blindness, and it makes one complicit with predators, frankly.
And if you do that, then you don't know what to do to look out for yourself or keep your kids safe. Yeah, it's this kind of burying your head in the sand attitude just really frustrates me.
Yeah, everyone out here trying to be camels. So offensive to me.
Anyway, having said that, I thought that I was going to be a lot angrier with Leda after this book than I ended up being. The stuff we got wasn't really new information, you know? So I'm wondering if there will be another book where we'll get more details if we do look into her murder. But maybe we're on the road to being less angry with her and focusing more on the healing and moving on. That's also possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. Even after what I was just saying, reading this for the first time, I was really thinking we were going to find out something even more horrible.
Me too. This is going off the chapter a bit, but do you think that the reader needs to have sympathy for a victim in order to care about their murder being solved? And I'm specifically thinking about Leda. I suppose the answer is no, because none of us liked Quine or Chisel, but it's definitely more emotional and more satisfying when it is someone you care about, like Margot.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think it'll be tough to top Margot as far as like victims whose murder you're invested in Strike and Robin solving. Though I do wonder if maybe solving Leda's murder will come close, not necessarily by making Leda more sympathetic, but as far as what it means to Strike to have that part of his life be cleared up.
Yeah. One doesn't necessarily have to care about the victim to be interested in the mystery being solved, but Rowling is really good at giving readers some reason to be emotionally invested, even with an unsympathetic victim, beyond just the intellectual curiosity of solving the puzzle. For Quine, there was the emotional hook of proving Leonora's innocence, right? We really cared.
And Orlando.
Yeah, and Orlando. And with Chisel, well, his murder was connected to the mystery of Billy and the girl who died, which was much more sympathetic and, you know, emotionally investable. Is that a word? Investable?
Sure, it works. It works. I know exactly what you mean.
But I agree that the most satisfying solves are when we are sympathetic to and invested in the victims themselves, like Margot.
Yeah, I guess when it comes to Leda, that emotion, like you're saying, Kens, will be on behalf of Strike, mostly Strike, obviously, but Lucy too. Kind of how Charlotte's death was emotional because of Strike's emotion. I think it could still possibly be a bit of a gut punch when that happens because of that. And also kind of just similar thinking here. This might sound terrible to admit. I kind of feel bad even saying this, but I don't think that I cared that much about Dayu as a character. It's so unfair because she was a child, this little girl who was killed in such a horrific way. But I was so caught up in the fear for Robin. And because Dayu is such a source of fear, it's almost like she became a villain in her own murder.
That's so interesting because I was feeling that way too.
Anyway, back to the actual chapter. I really liked the description of Mazu. It says, she looked like a witch, very white face, black hair, long pointed nose, and weird eyes.
And note with this description of Mazu, the description of Malcolm Crowther that we've just gotten, it mentions his black hair and it describes the visceral revulsion that Strike feels for him, which is the same sense of revulsion that Kevin here and later Robin feel about Mazu. And I don't know if it counts as a hint that Malcolm is Mazu's father, but I feel like it's a little indication of what she inherited from him, which, you know, black hair and creeping everyone the fuck out. if it is true that Malcolm was her father, I don't think we got definitive proof, but it does seem likely.
I mean, yeah, she sounds terrifying. I can see why Kevin had all those nightmares about her watching him.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's anything to that where he's dreaming that she's watching him through peepholes and skylights. It just kind of gives me this impression that she's always watching. And even if she's not, there's people who will report to her. You know, it kind of adds to the sense of her being all powerful and all knowing.
Yeah, I can imagine that growing up in Chapman Farm, being constantly surveilled, never alone, would tend to create a very deep-rooted fear of being watched by the object of your terror.
Yeah, it reminds me of the White Witch in Narnia, where she has eyes everywhere, you know?
Oh my God, yeah, just creepy as hell.
No Turkish delight in Chapman Farm, though.
No.
This bit here about Mazu not liking the women that Jonathan Wace sleeps with is interesting to me. It makes me curious about their relationship in general, because I don't know if we ever, do we ever see them appear as a couple? You know, are they ever affectionate with each other? Or is this relationship all about power? Robin says later on that you're supposed to love everyone equally, but that Jonathan Wace is only sleeping with the young and beautiful women. And I don't think Mazu is either of those things. It just makes me wonder if they even have a romantic or sexual relationship at this point still.
Yeah, I think that they each find that relationship very useful in terms of maintaining their power and position, obviously. But beyond that, I'd imagine that they're each drawn to something very twisted and monstrous that they recognize in each other. An enjoyment of inflicting pain, of controlling people. They're like really horrible kindred spirits. And maybe there's something powerful about that connection, but I don't know that we would recognize it as romantic love. I mean, they must have once had a sexual relationship because they have children together.
As far as I'm aware, I don't think that we see anything of them being like overtly affectionate with each other. I mean, in chapter 112, he calls Mazu my love a couple of times.
Yeah, but that's also performative, isn't it?
Exactly.
And it's saying like, it in front of a bunch of people.
Yeah. But that's the closest thing I think that we come to.
Strike is going to call Robin love one day.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Okay.
All right. Sorry. Let's go back to Kevin. He starts talking about how he came to leave the UHC and he introduces us to the Doherty family. This whole thing is also sad. This is Deirdre Doherty, the woman who wrote in her diary that Jonathan Wace raped her and as a result had Lynn. She came to the UHC with her husband and three children, and eventually her husband took the kids and escaped.
This woman is one I'm furious about because once we find out that it was the husband who made her go into the cult in the first place, and then abandons her there after she's raped and impregnated. And then a few months later, she dies. The poor woman. I wanted to punch that sorry excuse her husband in the face. But on another note about Lynn, I looked up the hexagram that Mazu named her after just to see if there's anything appropriate to her character in it. So this is hexagram 19 approach. And Lynn, the word, can be taken to mean becoming great, which, while Mazu may not have intended it, I think really speaks to Lynn's determination to save her daughter and the courage it took her to want to escape and the potential that she has outside of this cult. The hexagram says, if we meet evil before it becomes a reality, before it has even begun to stir, we can master it. And isn't that exactly what Lynn and Will do for Ching / Sally? Escape the evil of the cult before it destroys their daughter? And yes, I know that might be a reach, but standing by it.
Honestly, I don't think it's ever a reach to consider that a character name is important when the author is J.K. Rowling.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. There's quite a few paragraphs that tell the story about how Deirdre was expelled for writing in her diary that Jonathan Wace raped her. It's horrible reading this, knowing what actually happened to her, that she was drowned in that pool so shortly after this.
Yeah. Why do you think Deirdre wrote this, knowing that it would be read and that she'd be punished for it? Did she hope it would somehow reach someone who cared, who had sympathy for her, and push them into action? Was she naive and didn't realize that she would be punished for it and not Wace? Or was she simply determined to tell the truth and unable to lie anymore for this horrible cult, no matter what the consequences were?
I tend to think she was naive and hoping someone would help, but I don't know. We see that they're still careful about physically forceful rape. So maybe she thought that because of that, he would be held accountable or that someone would say, oh, that's not okay.
Yeah, maybe.
But it's also horrible reading about how Kevin was tied to a tree overnight as punishment.
Horrifying.
So Kevin was in a punishment the night that Deirdre died, which is why he wasn't at the manifestation. But he was also being punished during what I presume is the night after it's announced she was expelled, or night very soon after, because he heard expelled as he was tied to the tree. How many nights in a row did poor Kevin spend tied to this tree?
Oh God, I was hoping it was just one night. I don't know.
No, because Flora says he missed the manifestation. He missed the drowning because he was being punished. But the expulsion was announced the day after. And then Kevin hears them talking about expulsion. That's very concerning.
It's like the theme of this cult. That's very concerning.
Or, you know, maybe he misremembered and heard them talking about why the prophet would drown her. Let's fingers crossed for that, I guess.
I guess we could look at the good in this, that this helped him see the hypocrisy and everything. Mm-hmm. And then he starts talking about how he escaped. He climbed over a fence, which maybe is a little bit of foreshadowing about how Robin is going to do it.
I was wondering if that was what that was going to be whenever I was first reading it.
The fact that pretty much every member who's escaped has had to run away in the middle of the night climbing over fences should maybe be a hint to the authorities that the cult doesn't just let people walk away, right? That they're holding people against their will. I genuinely wonder what would happen if a member said, no, I want to leave, and went to walk out the front gate. Would they be dragged back and restrained, like forced into the box? We never got to see the cult's tactics for when manipulation and psychological coercion stopped working. And I'm curious.
I'm almost wondering if it depends on how much that person knows or how long they've been there. Because when Robin says to Tayo, I want to leave, that first time she gets out of the spirit bonding, I almost think that if she had pushed that, they might have let her, because at that point she hadn't seen enough. She has never been punished. There's nothing that could have threatened them if she left. So I kind of think at that point that they might have let her leave, but afterwards, I don't think so. I think it might depend. Yeah. But it's funny that you say that, because I was scrolling on TikTok the other day and I follow Leah Remini. She posted a video of how David Miscavige's secretary escaped Scientology. And I kind of want to share the video with everyone because it was so similar to Robin's escape. It was over a wall with barbed wire on top. And there was a man, her old, I don't know who he is to her, but an old friend or boyfriend waiting in a car outside on the street waiting for her. And the caption that Leah Remini wrote was almost exactly what you said, that if everyone is leaving this way, doesn't it tell people that they can't leave?
Exactly. Oh my God.
So anyway, we have a quick check-in with Strike, where he drinks more beer, and then he goes on to the next letter. And this letter is interesting because we get to learn about all the prophets. Let's start with Dayu. Am I understanding this correctly? The prophet thing didn't start until Dayu died, right? And then they kind of made the other ones prophets. Is that right?
Rusty Anderson and Graves, I believe, were already dead before Dayu. And they were made prophets retroactively. But then I believe that Coates and Margaret died after Dayu, and both were made prophets soon after their death. I think that's the order it went to. I think they started and then we're like, well, let's just do it till we get up to five to make a pentagon or whatever, pentagram, the five-sided. Yeah. That's our thing. So let's hit that magic number.
It's just strange how they went on for so many years before Dayu's death. Like, imagining this cult without these things is strange. And then it's also strange that they shifted so drastically and everyone just was like, okay,
we've got prophets now. Cool.
Yeah. Not that that's unrealistic, because you do see cults shift and escalate like this all the time. Yeah. I think one big thing is that Dayu wasn't liked by the other kids because she got special treatment. And after her death, Mazu was mean to the other kids. She especially didn't like girls. Jonathan had a daughter from his previous marriage, Abigail. Mazu got her moved out of Chapman Farm to one of the other UHC centers after Dayu's death. I think this is going to be highlighting our sibling rivalry here. Mm-hmm. Or sort of sibling rivalry. And I feel like I should have remembered it when all of the other sibling rivalries started popping up. And also, we know that it was actually Jonathan who moved Abigail to a different facility, not Mazu.
Yeah, that's right. And his motivation wasn't Mazu hating her, but the need to prevent anyone, especially Mazu, from finding out that there was something more suspicious about Dayu's death and that Abigail was involved. Although I'm sure Mazu was perfectly happy to have her gone. Like, she's not going to question why he moved her when it fits with what she wants.
Yeah. We get a brief introduction into Rusty Anderson, who became the wounded prophet, and we could talk about him more later. And Alexander Graves, who became the stolen prophet. Their deaths were preached about before the prophet thing came up as a way to warn people against leaving. So it must have been easy for them to just become prophets too.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The next one is Harold Coates, the healer prophet. I feel like I have a more personal hatred for him because he's the man who assaulted Lucy.
Mm-hmm. Fuck this guy.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine the fury I would feel if a church made a man who molested and abused me as a child into a literal prophet, and words can't express. I'm really thankful that Lucy never accidentally wandered into a UHC service, because she wouldn't have known it was connected to Chapman Farm, right? Because if she had, right, she'd have been confronted with a giant painting of her abuser on the ceiling and then a sermon about how great he was. Yeah. I'd have fucking lost it if I was her.
I know. They don't say how he died, but I hope it was painful, you know?
Fingers crossed.
The last prophet is Margaret Cathcart Bryce, another woman in love with or obsessed with Jonathan Wace, and gave the church all her money and became the Golden Prophet, which out of all the prophet names, that's the best one, in my opinion.
It's a pretty good name.
Yeah, what a
very good name. I had the most inappropriate thought the other day because I was watching the final season of Ghosts, and I was thinking about the scenario where literally on Chapman Farm, all of these five prophets are all there as ghosts watching everything unfold, and they're fighting about whose fault it is. You know, you gave him the money, it's your stupid saying about admitting the possibility, you know. It's just like all
that
of these
been so funny.
I kept reading it with this in mind of like them all still kind of there watching things happening and just in shock.
Yeah, I can picture that. I get what you're putting down there. That's good.
Anyway, Kevin explains that once they had the money from Margaret, they built the pool and the statue and dug up these four people, reburied them in tombs around the pool, which is, it's so creepy to me. I don't like this at all.
To be fair, it sounds like it would be a really nice memorial in a normal setting, like a cemetery, and not as part of an abusive cult. I mean, I love a fountain. They're lovely. They're nice.
I don't know. Part of it's eerie to me because Kevin is speaking about bodies being dug up and reburied, and he himself ends up, you know?
Yeah, I know. Also, side note, I felt weird about eating carrots ever since I read this book. Like, I know that they're not growing out of people, but it makes you feel a little weird.
Yeah, one thing I really hope happened after everything is that they were able to move Kevin's body and give him a normal burial off the farm.
I feel certain that Sir Colin would arrange for this and pay for a proper funeral. And I hope Emily goes.
Yeah, that's going to be my new headcanon for that. Because I need that.
We need some rays of hope.
This next bit was a little exciting for me when Kevin started talking about how spirits are real and that he had seen them. Obviously, I knew this was going to be some sort of trick, but I was really excited to see it happen and see how it was all going to unfold. Yeah. It actually helped me with my expectations of when Robin would escape, because I knew she wasn't going to leave Chapman Farm before we saw the Drowned Prophet manifestation.
I was dreading whatever was going to happen in that manifestation, the whole book, because, yeah, we were going to see that. And I was right to dread it. It was awful.
I was kind of looking forward to it because I knew that it was going to be the ending of her time there. And also just I was interested in how they were going to show her.
That's fair.
This final line of Kevin's email is a great ending to the chapter. Maybe you think I'm crazy, but I'm telling the truth. The UHC is evil and dangerous, but there is another world and they found a way into it.
Such a creepy, ominous ending. It's like,
it makes me think of Stranger Things. Like you found your portal into the upside down.
The upside down. That's got me excited to see where this cult is. What they're doing.
Yeah, of course. Now.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.